welcome to WBAA's Off the Field with Morgan Burke. It's our biweekly conversation about the big issues in sports with Purdue's athletics director. Good to see you, and it's been a fairly good week for Purdue athletics, all in all.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't really enjoy the weekend down in Bloomington, but I did have an opportunity to watch the men in Maui, and our women right now in basketball are close. We have to remember that Courtney Moses and K.K. Hauser, who are two basketball players who graduated and will go down in the annals as some of the best in Purdue history, had that ball in their hand a lot of the time. And that banter, you know, we've now passed the baton, if you will, to April and Ashley and some other players who are very, very talented, but they're still just getting their sea legs. So people have to give the team a little bit of a break here as they get going. But I think Sharon will get them moving along. Matt's guys are right now playing at a high level, and they're excited. And certainly the crowd on this past week against North Carolina State was into it.
I wanted to spend some time today, if we could, on what I thought was a really interesting press conference that you held for those of us in the media earlier this week. And you made an interesting comment about wanting to be more of an advocate for the athletics programs and for the department. I wanted to give you a second to sort of expound here on what you meant.
Well, let me put that in perspective. I think I've always been an advocate. But I think there's a segment of our fan base that feels that my advocacy has been very general in nature, and it refers generically to athletics. And that the concern was whether or not I was placing sufficient emphasis on the need to build football at Purdue. That's really where I was going. Again, I spend I'm the sport administrator in addition to the athletic director for football and men's basketball. So I will assure you, I spend countless hours with those two teams, in particular football. So that's important for me to get a sense of what's going on in the program, how the kids are feeling, how the coaches are feeling alike. But when I come out publicly, I will generally talk more generically. I mean, I have 18 different families, if you will. And if it comes across that I'm only favoring one sport, then you'll get a backlash somewhere else. But pretty clear to me that at least a segment of our fan base was misconstruing that. So I was going to make very clear that they understood that this particular program, any of our programs, particularly your larger revenue programs that are in a period of distress, if you will, that's probably when a leader needs to be a little bit more expressive about what you're doing within that program to try to make things improve. So when I refer to the advocacy, that's what I'm referring to. And, you know, football is something unique. It's a unique American experience. Very few times, particularly on this campus or other large campuses, do you have the opportunity to bring thousands of former students and current students together to celebrate Purdue. And, you know, you want to make it an exciting environment. I'd like to win every game. But more importantly, you want people to look forward to anticipation to come together for the game, but also the auxiliary events that surround the game, many of which involve academic programs and other auxiliaries here on campus.
I get the sense that there was some sort of maybe criticism you were feeling from some people from the outside that caused you to kind of reassess where you were going in terms of your advocacy.
When you're 3-9, there's always going to be criticism. So you have to accept that. And I got out in front. People may say, well, geez, why did you do that on such a short notice after the Bucket game? I think when you have a situation where you have a program that's struggling as big as football, somebody has to get out in front, and that happens to be the person in my chair. And Daryl and his staff appropriately were out on the road recruiting. I think they've had a good week from all accounts that I've gotten. And I felt very strongly that you know, people needed to hear from me and get my sense for where I thought the program was. And I think the feedback I've gotten on the comments has been good. I think people feel like, okay, I've got a better perspective of how you're viewing it, which is what I'd hoped for. And you're always going to have some people on either side who chip away at you, but that's just the nature of the world. Everybody can have a comment today. It could be a tweet. I just don't think you can manage by tweets. If you do that, you'll take your eye off the ball and you won't get to where you want to be.
you also said that, and you pointed out just a second ago, you said you've always been an advocate, but in the press conference you said maybe in the past it's been more in meetings and behind mm-hmm. closed doors and with your staff in close, and now it sounded like you were going to be more forward, more outward looking with it. Is that a good way of putting it?
Yeah, and I'm going to look for opportunities to when I think there's an important point to get it out. And it doesn't mean I'm always going to do a press conference, but I think I need to be a little bit more visible. I've always taken the approach, I think it's the right one, that if things are going well in the department, you probably shouldn't see me. It's about the student athletes and it's about the coaches and their programs. But when you're struggling, whether it be on the field or in another area of the department, I think that's when a leader has to become more visible. And we're at a point in time right now where we believe this program, as I pointed out, we know it's a bottom line business. And yet I do think the people on the other side who point to the improvements have a perspective that's factual in nature. So I'm, as I pointed out, I'm somewhere in between. I think that it is a bottom line business. I don't think we have enough playmakers yet that have been able to demonstrate their ability to shift a game at a critical juncture. Now, I think Danny Anthrop was at that point before he got hurt. But you need to have several of those people so that if it's a key offensive play on 3rd and 6, you make the play. If it's a key 3rd and 10 on defense, you make the stop. And we're just not quite there yet. And I think my biggest concern, disappointment this year, is I thought there were certain games where the offense played at a very high competitive level, a level that you could win with. And there were times when the defense played at a level that you need in order to win. But they just didn't seem to click together in the same game. And when Darryl and I get a chance to visit at the end of the season, which I do with every coach, kind of go through a program review, I want to ask him, what do you think caused that? Now, some of it can be the opponents you play. They're good. And we played some good opponents in the middle of the season, so you don't want to take anything away from them. But I guess, you know, if we had played at a high level consistently on both sides of the ball as we showed we were capable of, I think the point that others have made that there were 4 or 5 games that could have flipped your way is not an unreasonable statement. So, again, we didn't get where we wanted to be, so we have to accept that accountability. And I always like to say the accountability for performance resides in my office. There are people who shoulder responsibility for leading activities in the area, but make no mistake, I feel the accountability. And I think we have some people, they don't hear that word. It's almost like you're ducking it, and I'm not ducking anything.
So as you are doing more of this outward advocacy role, what does that mean that people are going to see from you? Is it going to be more high-fiving, more pumping people up, more fundraising, some of all of it?
Yeah, I think some of all of it. In some respects, people who know me best will say that's just business as usual. But to people who right now have concerns about whether that program is getting what it needs, whether it's getting sufficient attention, I've got to make sure whether it's me directly or through my staff, that we are continuing to put the best foot forward. Matt Rector, who's our football SID, and Tom Schott do a great job. And I need to make sure that we continue to get information out to people that will create, a clearer picture of the things that are going on to support football. And I want to, you know, I think at this particular point in time, Darryl Hazel is the guy. I'm confident in that, and I'm confident in this staff. And I want to make that very clear. These people have been in a lot of tough spots. They've been at programs that were struggling. They've been at programs that have won championships. So they've been through this before, and that's important right now because you can get a little bit battle fatigued by the folks that are kind of chipping away at you. If you allow that to happen, you won't get to where you want to be. You have to be very, very strong-willed. You have to listen to all sides, but you can't try to placate one part of the fan base and make them happy, because the only thing that's going to make people happy is to perform on the field.
This is WBAA's Off the Field with Morgan Burke. If ever you've got a question for us, you can always email that to news@wbaa.org. You spent a fair amount of time in the press conference also talking about the necessary retrofits to Ross-Ade Stadium. You called it a 19th century stadium, and clearly here we are in the 21st century. And you and I have talked on this program about what it might take to get more fans into the stadium, some of the amenities you might add. But now you're at the point where you have to figure out how to fund those sorts of things. And so how do you go about, especially with the football program, as you said the other day, you know, bringing in $3 million less than was expected and you having to dip into reserves to cover some of those costs, how do you find what must be a large sum of money to do what's needed at Ross 8?
Well, I think I need to make sure you and our viewers or listeners understand we're at the end of the first quarter of a game. There's a lot of work to be done. We have concepts now that have got to be translated into a program of activity, which would lead to a budget. So we've got you're down the road in terms of how the how-tos. I'm not sure this juncture, but I wasn't sure in 2006 how we'd do Mackey either. And I didn't anticipate – we didn't anticipate the Great Recession, but we found a way to get it done. So I'm not going to get – you can get so concerned about the how-tos that you don't allow the process to continue. We know that the bleachers that were in Ross 8 were from Lambert Fieldhouse, and they were going to have to be removed at a point in time. We created an interim a solution this year that people really enjoyed. The South End Zone patio area showed that this whole idea of mixing and mingling and people being able to see each other was important. Some people like to sit in their seats and just watch the game. They'll put a headset on, listen to Tim Newton and Pete Quinn, and they're happy. Other people want to be able to watch the game but also have a conversation, maybe with somebody lives in another part of the county or the state, and they want to catch up with them. So viewing patterns at athletic events are really shifting. Ross 8 just had its 90th birthday, by the way, this about 2 weeks ago, November, I think, 24th or 26th in 1924 was the original a game against Indiana in the bucket game in Ross 8. So you have a building that's 90 years old. In about 2000, 2001, we made some major improvements. Now, most people see the size of the pavilion and think that that was the improvement. That was about 10% of the cost of that project. The reality is the bulk, 90% of that expense was restrooms, concrete, repair. It's a big bowl. It's a big structure that needs time and attention. During the 30 or so years prior to that renovation, all we'd really done in the stadium was add seats, try to grow the viewing capacity with very little emphasis on the infrastructure. So on our watch, we inherited that challenge. So we got that piece fixed. And we had a master plan that would have allowed us to put a deck on the east side. That continues to be a possibility if we get to that point, as well as a deck on the north side. What we didn't anticipate in 2000, and one reason why you do a master plan, so that you have a view of where you're trying to go, is that viewing patterns were going to change. TV grew at an astronomical rate. It almost takes a full page to get the sports TV listings anymore in the newspaper. That's had a dramatic effect on attendance. I will tell you, interest is not down. If you look at ratings on TV, information about radio broadcasts, social media, the websites, it's at all-time high. But people are doing it in different ways. Some people have got their ESPN to go and they're watching on their tablets. Some are doing it on their smartphones.
It's a much more fragmented experience.
Much more. So that then... As we got into this, we recognized bigger may not be better. And then we sat there and said, you know, what are those people who've got 100,000-person stadiums going to do? Because the ticket bases throughout the United States are aging. Because the generation behind is more inclined to do two or three games, or they want to be more social.
So you think this could be worse at the Michigans and the Ohio States
of
the world?
I absolutely do. Unless you're really hot. If you're really hot, you're probably insulated. But not everybody's going to be hot every year.
So it's going to be worse at Michigan.
Well, you know, or whoever's not hot. You know, Tennessee's not hot right now. Florida's not hot right now. So what we came to the conclusion is we wanted to take a good hard look at how to reprogram that space. We do not feel at this juncture we need a bigger stadium. We need a stadium that caters to more needs and more wants. The project has three primary elements. Two of them must be done in this span between now and 2020. We have some maintenance to do, so there's some concrete and steel repair work and painting of the undershell that need to be accomplished. Secondly, we have technology needs. The scoreboard is reaching the end of its useful life. It's about 8 years old, and these boards are generally about 10 years is about how long they'll last. So that needs to change out. The sound system is awful. Everybody that comes to the games knows that we've got problems. It's blaring, and that needs to be fixed. We will put lights in because we know there's going to be, with the next round of television negotiations, where in the past they've paid for those lights that have come in. Now it's going to be our responsibility. So we're better off now to include that in the physical plant.
To make them a permanent fixture.
That's correct. And I think you need to look at a scoreboard in the or a smaller video board in the North Horseshoe so people don't have to look each way. I think a ribbon board around the perimeter of the top of the stadium would also allow you to scroll, like you'd see on the ESPN ticker, information that would be of interest to people during the course of the game. So all those pieces got to be done. The maintenance has got to be done. So the question is, what do you do with the south end zone? So we, you know, well over a year ago, asked HNTB at the end of the Mackey project to take a crack at it. They agreed to put some preliminary work, very preliminary work together. And I would have to say that when we put that out to people, they kind of yawned. Very clear that we didn't hit the mark. And that's when we as a team pulled back and said, you know, we're not going at this right. And we sat and talked with the university architect, Larry Fasaro, who's worked with us on Mackey. And Larry suggested, and we thought it was a great idea, let's do a design competition. So we got six very, very prominent sports architecture firms to come in, and they came in at homecoming, and we kind of walked them through what our thoughts were, and that's where the 19th century Victorian mansion analogy came from. But we gave them an opportunity now to view our venues and to take 6 to 8 weeks to put together their concepts. We now have the concepts back. We don't have a detailed plan or a detailed program. So I couldn't begin to tell you what the cost would be until you take the concept and build a program and know exactly what you've got. So that's why I say we're really somewhere at the end of the first quarter.
Let me take a piece of that just for a second, just to see if I can get a sense for myself, because I've never had to buy a scoreboard or a ribbon board, as you might imagine. What do those things cost these days?
Depends on the size, but you a board of the size that we're contemplating in the south end zone could be in the $5 to $10 million range.
Just for the scoreboard?
Sure.
Holy cow.
Yeah. So it's not an insignificant amount that we'll be looking to do. And we know there's probably $15 million worth of maintenance that needs to be done one way or another, whether you do anything in the venue or not, just for crowd safety. Now, we're not in an imminent danger concern right now, but you don't want to wait until the 11th hour on that stuff. So there, I've given you two items, one scoreboard and the maintenance, and I got you over $30 million. So, I mean, it you know, when you're all said and done, this will be a large undertaking. It's a large project. So we'll visit with some people in the near future to kind of narrow that list down to maybe three or four firms. We'll then have some discussions with the president and the board about what we think is the right concept, get their reaction. From there, you begin by hiring the architect. You'll work with the architect for the better part of the next year, all of 2015, to try to take this original concept and kind of dial it into what we want at Purdue. You're then probably in 16, early 16, in a position where you know the dollars.
And so not until you work with the architect could you even ever go to the Board of Trustees and say, here's what
absolutely.
We think it's going to cost.
Absolutely. All I can go to the Board of Trustees now is say, look, I think it's time to get the architect involved. And this is the concept we like, and this is why we like it. And now let us work with that architect over the course of the year to refine, you know, how many square feet are you going to have? You know, how many plugs do you need in the walls? All the kinds of stuff you need to know in order to build a budget. So we're just not there at this point in time. But this thing carries so much excitement for people. And I saw it when we did the first plan on Rossade that when people see it, they think the switch is going to flip tomorrow. It won't. But you have to begin to put things out there, and we will at an appropriate time. So you build interest, support, and commitment from your fan base, because we're all going to have to put some nickels in the kitty, or we aren't going to make this happy. I think there are other revenue streams that will come along that will help this, but at this point in time, I'm going to cause my team to concentrate on just defining what this scope of the program looks like, and we'll be the first of many stadiums that are going to go through this. And if we can get on the leading edge, I think we can do just something distinctive. In my opinion, in the last 65 years, Purdue and Purdue Athletics has done one project that I would consider to be transformative. And that was in the mid-60s when Fred Hovde and Red Mackey decided to go against the grain and build Mackey Arena. It was a huge, huge gamble. A big structure, bigger than we'd ever had. Could it be filled? Red Mackey was worried. There's quotes to that effect in the media. And the architecture is so different from this campus, this big circular building. And yet, if you look back now with the renovation, that building probably will last us 75 years. Has become an icon for this campus. So I like to look at football in a similar vein. There are seven Saturdays and a spring game. So that gives you 8 weeks of activity. There are 32 weeks in the two semesters, 16 in each, the fall and the spring semester. So 25% of your school year. I anticipate that programming to support Purdue as a whole can occur in each of those 8 weeks. And I think when Murray Blackwelder was here, we did that. We did a lot of the celebration of Purdue. So you might have a gift announcement on a Wednesday. You might have a Dean's Advisory Committee meeting on a Thursday. You might have a PRF company come in and have their board meetings. But a whole series of activities, convocations, lectures, all built into game week. And so to me, the football game is an opportunity to bring thousands of people together on the campus and from outside the campus. And to have them, sure, enjoy the football game, but to celebrate all things Purdue.
So it sounds like you want to have meetings with people who are completely outside of athletics, and you want to say, come and spend your time at Purdue leading up to the game with Wisconsin, leading up to the game with Northwestern, and you want to have them hang around for the football game after they've been here for something that's completely unrelated to athletics.
Absolutely, and it may not be the whole week, don't misunderstand me, but you could have a Dean's Advisory Committee meeting on a Friday, and they have a dinner for the group, and then they come to the game on Saturday. But you should build programming around it. And we've done this once before. Murray Blackwelder was really good at understanding the power of using football as a magnet to build activities leading up to the game. And I think we need to do the same thing. I think it's a natural. And then people enjoy the socialization that goes on a football game. It's certainly about the game, Stan, but it's also about the ability for people to interact. They might be talking a little bit more about things that occurred in their meeting, or they talk about a lecture, or they went to a show at Elliott Hall of Music. It's celebrating all things Purdue.
You also said that you need to fall in line with the president's push to keep things affordable at Purdue. And then you said, well, look at where our ticket prices are. You said they're still not as high as they are in a lot of places in the Big Ten. So how do you balance those two things to judge what affordability is in this day and age?
Well, I would tell you, if it was as easy as just giving tickets away free, you'd be full every week, right? I mean, there has to be value in the product. It's not solely the price of a ticket. I've tried to make sure over the last few years that we have ticket options that have been available. Maybe in some cases we've done too many things, but you know, we introduced a family zone so that a family of four could get to a game for $50. We tried to parallel off what would it take if you took your kids to a movie. And so we've tried to be sensitive to the various segments. I'm right now, we've got a student group that's worked with us for the last 8 weeks, trying to look at what we can do to bolster student attendance. And Mitch and I and others on the campus were eager to kind of see what they come up with. There's different ways to get things accomplished. I think this group has been they've gone through the benchmarking exercise. They've looked at what other schools have done. They've looked at loyalty and reward programs. They've looked at a whole host of things. And they'll be visiting here with us before the end of the semester, and I'll be eager to see what they come up with. I think you're at the point in time, and I've mentioned this earlier in our talks, where the television revenue is much greater now than it used to be. It used to be that the television revenue and gate receipts were about equal. It's now clearly gone to TV. So I'm not sure you need to do much with pricing. I know a lot of people are concerned that if we do any renovation in Ross A, we're going to jack the ticket prices up. I'm not sure that's the way you go. Will we do some kind of capital campaign? Sure, we will have to do that. But I don't see us increasing the ticket prices at a point in time where it becomes a deterrent. And I think in the student case, we've got to look at how to create value that causes them to want to come to the games without putting an additional financial burden on them.
Is it, I don't know enough about the economics of this, so I wanted to ask you, is it possible to have a blanket student program where, say, all student tickets cost $5 or $10, and students know I can go to any home game for this fixed price. First, is that possible? And second, do you think that would work to draw more students to Saturday games?
Well, I want to see what the students come back with. I don't want to preempt them. But remember, we have allocated about 12,000 or so seats in Rossay. We have more available right now. But you're trying to make sure that you plan for all of your market segments. It gets a little trickier in Mackey. You know, you're looking at about 4,800 seats out of the 14,000 that we allocate to students. If all of a sudden 7,000 students wanted a ticket, we couldn't accommodate it. So you gotta find a balance there. And I think listening to some of the things that I've heard from the students, there's probably a way to do something that's pretty aggressive in football, and something that in basketball recognizes there's a little bit more of a constrained inventory in there. But I want to make it simpler. We have the technology today to load their passes. We do their tickets electronically even today. And some of our fans have kind of gotten into that mode. I mean, I think in the next few years, I hope we're like the airlines. You have the tickets sent right to your smartphone. You save the image, and then we have all the barcoding technology. It's just it's a cleaner way to do it. You aren't putting more paper in the landfills. It's the right thing to do. And it saves us money because our back office spends a lot of money stuffing envelopes on those tickets. So, it's that particular how to use technology, how to appeal to the fan base are all things we got to spend a lot of time on. But the students will be the emphasis in the early part of this latter part of 14, early part of 15.
In just our last 30 seconds or so here, you mentioned you've got 12,000 student tickets in Rossay. That's about a fifth of the stadium's total capacity. I would say you probably didn't have 12,000 students for any home game this year. So there's a balance between how many do you allocate and how do you get those existing ones filled. Is there a short-term something that people can expect next season?
I don't know. Stan, I don't want to prejudge that. I can tell you that if you get into the pattern of people waiting for discounts, that's a bad thing. The automobile companies would tell you they kind of wish they'd never gotten into the discount business. That's what people wait for. So I don't want to get there. I'd like to get a price point that makes sense. I will assure you that if somebody's heading down to the Village, $5 or $10 is nothing. So I think people get hung up on the price. I think you got to make it comparable to what they would experience for something else that they would use for discretionary income. I would say in closing, we did do something at Northwestern that was interesting. We had a bus go down and pick people up through the Village. Pretty successful, so we'll probably look at continuing that in the future.
All right. Well, thanks for your time as always, and we'll talk to you again in 2 weeks.
Great. Thank you.
This has been WBAA's Off the Field with Morgan Burke. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.